This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV nationwide and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates. The French just finished their second round of elections, handing newly elected centrist Prime Minister Emmanuel Macron a strong parliamentary majority. Mr. Macron has promised a pro-market agenda and is opposed from the right by the anti-immigrant Marine Le Pen and from the left by the populist Jean-Luc Mélenchon. Sunday's parliamentary elections drew a record low turnout, however. Meanwhile, in neighboring Britain, where citizen applications to France have jumped by more than 250% in the past year, the aftermath of Prime Minister Theresa May's snap elections are still unfolding. May, who was hoping to have a greater mandate to carry out Britain's exit from the European Union and apply a strong set of neoliberal austerity measures, has been left politically weakened, especially after the new Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn energized young voters. My guest is Larry Bensky, a longtime award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He teaches political science at California State University, East Bay, and has just finished teaching a class in European government there. And he's a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the show, Larry.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to be back with you again.
So first, let's talk about Macron and France. So what does it mean that A, that the turnout was low, and that B, that with that low turnout, Macron got a big parliamentary majority?
The way that the elections are scheduled in France and have been since 2002 is that immediately following a presidential election, there is a parliamentary election in just 2 weeks. And it's in two rounds because you have to get more than half the votes in every district, the 577 districts. In the first round, there were only, I think, two people elected. So everything was in a runoff. And then in the second round, as you said, the abstention, which was great even in the first round, got to be even more. And the vote total was something like 42% of the eligible voters. This is being interpreted in various ways by various people, but the major people who study this seriously at Sciences Po in Paris and other reputable organizations and institutions is that people are evidencing what is obvious in other countries, Britain that you mentioned, Germany, etc. They no longer believe in the electoral politics system. It's not that they're ready to become revolutionaries and overturn the government by force and violence. It's just that there's too much baggage now for electoralism in Europe to be something that people really, really are into. The baggage includes, of course, corruption, of which there's a never-ending stream, and it's already begun to impact Macron's government that he's formed. He's had two ministers resign already. It's the other element that is major in it is it's become too complex and too distant from the people. You have the European governmental structures, the EU, which is what the Britons voted to leave. The EU is so complicated that it's almost impossible for anybody to understand it. Even teachers like me who try to impart to students some sense of coherence in the structures, it's very hard to break down all the different governmental bodies, what their powers are, who's in them. But the thing that they all have in common is what's called a democracy deficit. People don't vote to put people in all but one of the bodies that have tremendous powers over Europe, the Economic Council, the Military Councils, the Legal Councils. People don't get elected to those. They get appointed in various ways by governments and by other elected parliamentarians. Only the European Parliament itself is voted on, and those elections are so obscure that almost nobody votes in those. So more and more people, and we see this in France this time with the abstentionism, are saying with their feet, we either don't understand this system or it doesn't seem to be part of the major issues that are confronting us in our daily lives. And therefore, we're not going to participate in it because they, quote unquote, will do what they want anyway. The other element I should bring up quickly is that there's an anti-elitist feeling here, which is that everybody who runs for office, and Macron, by the way, is a classic example of this, is a highly educated, extremely credentialed person who they all go to the best schools. whether or not they're left, right, or center, they all know each other, they all hang out together, their families intermarry with each other. In other words, there's a governing elite, almost like a monarchist situation. And the people who live in these countries resent that, don't relate to it very well, and now they're voting with their feet by staying away from the system that further entrenches these politicians with powers.
So what about Marine Le Pen of the National Front? How did she fare in these elections? And does her voice or her ability to capture what some in the far right are experiencing, does it outweigh her actual political clout?
She got elected to parliament this time, and she brought with her seven other deputies from the National Front, the extreme right-wing, xenophobic, anti-immigrant nationalist party. So they have eight deputies in parliament. However, there are 577 deputies in parliament. So you can't say that she has a whole lot of clout or is going to have a whole lot of clout. And the way the French parliament is organized, you have to have at least 15 deputies in order to be officially recognized as a group, in order to get financial subsidies, in order to get the right to speak issues more frequently. So they're not there. However, this is better than some people thought she would do. The polls prior to the second round of the French elections said she was going to be the only one elected from her party. She would have been one out of 577. So now she has eight. That is not a significant presence. And it's a very disappointing showing for somebody who earlier said that she was going to have at least 100 members of parliament, and others gave her 50 or 60. The more that the French public became exposed to Marine Le Pen and the phenomenon of the National Front, the less they liked it. And of course, she got into the runoff against Macron for the presidency about a month ago. And there again, she was beaten by 2-1. So her party, it's foolish to say that they've disappeared, but they're very weak now. All of the gnashing of teeth and pulling of hair that we had from the commentariat leading up to the French elections, that this was the second rise of fascism and that it was taking all over Europe. And then we had a different result in various countries like Austria, a different result in Poland, a different result in France, and different results in other smaller elections, Italy too. So it's not as if the prognostications of about 6 months ago that France is heading Donald Trump's way and the whole world is moving to the far right and blah, blah, blah. Well, it's not clear that even the United States was moving to the far right, although we certainly elected somebody who could be seen as an icon of the far right. But the National Front and Marine Le Pen, they'll make a lot of noise. They've always made a lot of noise and they'll continue to make a lot of noise. But I don't think they're going to count very much, if at all, when it comes to serious policy decisions.
Larry, what about Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who many have compared to Jeremy Corbyn and Bernie Sanders, who captured a lot of young people's imagination in the first round of the elections? Did his party and his allies win any kind of serious support in parliament?
Well, yes, they have enough. They have more than 15. They have 17 or 18. So they will be a group in parliament. But there again, it's a disappointing showing for the left. And one of the major takeaways of this French election was the almost total disappearance of the left as an electoral body in France. If you add together Jean-Luc Mélenchon's party, his newly formed group, La France Insoumise, the rebel French, and the Communist Party, what's left of it, which now has fewer than 3% of the vote, and various other left groups, including the Greens, who managed to get one deputy elected out of 577, you come up with the lowest percentage of people backing progressive political parties in France that I can remember, certainly in my lifetime and in the lifetime of France immediately before my lifetime. So you see here a long trajectory from 1921, when the SFIO, the Socialist Party, was founded, and up through the Front Populaire in the 30s and the post-war when the Communist Party was very strong, and the François Mitterrand era of 1981 and on, all of that has been swept away this time, and the entire left. Now, Jean-Luc Mélenchon is a very eloquent and powerful and forceful speaker, but he has not shown himself or his party and movement to be the kind of energy-gathering force that is going to allow the left, the progressive left in France, to have a major impact. They are much more outnumbered by the Macron people, who are basically justifiers of finance capitalism. We can get into that if you want to, who these people are and what their philosophy is. But Mélenchon himself got elected, by the way, to parliament this time for the first time. He's one of his party's 17 or 18 deputies. So he and Marine Le Pen are going to be out there, you know, shooting off sparks, shooting off their mouths all the time and getting a lot of media coverage. But essentially, the action now is with Macron's party, which, along with his associate party, has 350, 360 seats out of the 577. They're the ones who have the momentum behind them to put together something which they will count on to establish themselves as a political force going far into the future. But it's much too soon to say anything about this election, what the centrists signify, but we can certainly say that for the left in France, this is a very, very strong and severe blow.
Let's turn to Britain. Pankaj Mishra, writing today in the New York Times, that's on Tuesday in the New York Times, had a really interesting piece, The Rise of Jeremy Corbyn and the Death Throes of Neoliberalism. And some of this may apply to France as well. Do you see what has played out in Britain with the recent snap elections that Theresa May held as, in a sense, a referendum on the failures of neoliberal capitalism and these austerity measures that Theresa May and her allies have been pushing over and over?
In England, yes, that's definitely true. The British public has indicated that it is, as has the French, by the way, that they are very conscious of the fact that corporations are doing just fine. They don't need tax cuts anymore. Corporations are doing just fine. They don't need stricter labor laws so it's easier to lay people off and fire people. The corporations are doing just fine. They don't need more laws that say that you can hire people at lower wages. The corporations are doing just fine. They've managed to defang and weaken enormously labor unions, which are really workers' only defense against corporations. Corporations are doing just fine in England and in France. The people are not doing fine. The people are not doing fine because more and more they see that their purchasing power is eroded, that the situation of unemployment, especially in France, is one that is now chronic and structural, and governments of the right and governments of the moderate left, the socialists, have been unable to do anything meaningful about it. The people see that their health plans and their health coverage are being eroded. I mean, there's a sort of a presupposition that France has a single-payer universal health care system. It doesn't. It needs one. So does this country. What it ha- and Britain doesn't have one that's as comprehensive as it used to be anymore either. People see this, Sonali, when you have a condition of yourself or your family or friends, and you start trying to get medical treatment for it, and you find out that, number one, you have to sometimes go out of system in order to get it. Number two, you have to pay for it unless you're extremely poor. Number three, prescription medicine is not exactly free all the time. The more expensive the prescription, the more you're expected to pay for it. People see this, and it's not what they signed up for when they signed up as citizens in those countries. In the case of England, the Labour Party has a whole different tradition of how it approaches social solidarity and social benefits and the social network. It's not about creating a smoother series of deals between workers and corporate capitalism. There can be no smoother series of deals between workers and corporate capitalism until there's an equality of power. And there's not an equality of power right now.
Well, of course, the issue of Brexit looms large in Britain. Many have compared the Brexit vote and the shock that it delivered to the British population with what happened here in the United States last November with the election of Trump. Now, do the results of the snap election held by that Theresa May called, do they now mean that the way in which Britain exits the EU is going to be different? People are talking about a soft exit. What does this mean?
It's a good question, and nobody knows what it means because it's a slogan. It's not a strategy, and it's not a tactic. A soft exit would mean that Britain could continue to have the trade advantages with European countries, and of course, there are tremendous economic ties between European countries, mainland European countries, and the island nation of Great Britain. But The soft exit would mean that there would basically be no meaningful change in commercial relationships, and that's not going to happen. The people of Europe, the governments of Europe, and all those complicated structures that I referred to, the European Union, have noticed that Britain, a significant proportion of people in Britain, and by the way, if that vote was held again tomorrow, I don't think it would turn out the same way, but in any case, for now, they've got to proceed as if it does. This is going to be negotiated over a two-year period, and that's a long time. And you don't even have the officials in place yet who are going to be the ones who are doing the negotiating. It brings me back to France, by the way. You mentioned I teach political science and government here in the in Northern California, in Hayward, in Cal State East Bay. One of the things that we study in political science is how does government actually function? Right now, Macron's party and his allies have a series of working groups that have been working for several months now, when it became obvious that Macron had a good chance of getting elected, trying to figure out how they can put in something called flexicurity. Flexicurity. Flexicurity is kind of what exists in Denmark, whereas the workers have an assurance that they have guaranteed work, that they have an assurance that should they be laid off, they have decent benefits, that they have an assurance that when they retire, their pensions will be there, and that in exchange for this, they give certain advantages to corporations, like the corporations don't really have to deal with unions anymore. They can deal with workplace bodies that are sub-unions, that the boards of appeal that exist to decide what a person gets paid or what a group of people get paid if their factory closes, that those boards of appeal will have much smaller powers and be more locally focused. And what Macron says is that labor unions are anti-democratic. Macron takes an attitude, if people are familiar with the philosophy, such as it is, of Thomas Friedman, the great free market guru of the New York Times, which basically says, we live in a new era now. Everything's different. We don't need unions anymore. We're in a new cyber space, cyber negotiations, the gig economy. Look at Uber, look at Amazon. Well, guess what? People who work for Uber and people who work for Amazon still are trying to make a living. And in order to do so, they need some sort of collective power. They're not going to get collective power out of Macron's approach and all the people who came into office with Macron. Macron has brought in a whole bunch of younger, more dynamic technocrats who don't owe their powers to coming up inside the Conservative Party or the Socialist Party or the Communist Party. He's brought in a whole new group of people, but what they have in common is they're all believers in this universal blessings of capitalism that Thomas Friedman and all of those people believe in. And once you believe in that, you're basically believing in the tooth fairy, I believe, of human behavior. Because as long as one series of people, corporate capitalism owners and runners, whose basic devotion is to what? The bottom line and profits, maximizing of profits. Once you take them on one side and put on the other side the workers who have what? The rights of individuals. That's what Macron keeps saying. We need not collective rights, we need individual rights. Well, of course we need individual rights. You know, we need individual rights to breathe clean air. We need individual rights to love and marry who we want to. We need individual rights to control our own bodies. We need all kinds of individual rights, but those individual rights are not going to necessarily impact the economic stand, the economic abilities of individuals to live a comfortable, safe, stress-free life. And one thing people should remember about France is that French consume more anti-anxiety medicine than any population on the planet.
Even the U.S.?
Yes.
Wow.
France is number one. And people always say, well, it's because prescription medicine is free in France. Well, prescription medicine, first of all, is not necessarily free. It depends on your level of income. But second of all, there's something about how work is structured in France that can drive you nuts. I mean, they invented bureaucracy and they've brought it to a fine art over the years. People want a simplification, yes. And if Macron and his people can make things simpler, well, that so much the better. But if being simple still means that you still have to worry about where's your money going to come from, the fin du mois difficile that they call in France, it will be the end of the month, you're out of money, you don't know what you can do, so you beg and borrow in unfortunately steal in order to get through to the next month when your salary is coming or your social benefits are coming. Unless there's something done to change that, people's mentality doesn't automatically change because they've elected a 39-year-old president or that they've elected a political party, 90% of whom have never held office before. So it's not necessarily going to be an automatically transferable, wonderful thing that Macron and his people have come in. In fact, there's an argument to be made that unless Macron changes his tune and his approach to things, he will be doing nothing but energizing the Mélenchons and the unions to get more militant, which is what happens in France. If you start tinkering with the social contract in France, even though only 8% of the workers are in unions, 70 or 80% of the population agrees with the stance that those unions take. So if you start tinkering with that, you're going to find the trains stop running. You're going to find the electricity stops being produced. You're going to find all the things that happen when there's a generalized strike and workers exercise their power.
Right.
What Macron knows this. He's trying to defang the unions. He's trying to make nicey-nice with them. He's trying to pick them off one by one. We'll see if that works.
Right. I mean, the general strike is very much part of a French culture. I want to sort of take a broader look, Larry, and head finally into how these issues and these developments in Europe are relevant to the U.S. It seems as though, broadly speaking, we have a three kind of, you know, the sort of, not what's the trichotomy, if you will, where you've got people on the far right who often take advantage of the anti-immigrant sentiment. So people like Marine Le Pen in France, Nigel Farage in the UK, Trump and his ilk in the US. You've got people on the left like Jean-Luc Mélenchon, arguably, Jeremy Corbyn, Bernie Sanders, and then you've got the centrist technocrats. And I'm glad you used that term, technocrats. So Macron in France, to an extent, Theresa May, and of course here in the U.S., Obama and Clinton. I know that that's kind of very broadly speaking a way to look at the world, but doesn't that help us understand where we are at today? That in France, the center has won, in Britain, the center has won, in the U.S., the right has won.
Let me put an issue out here, Sonali, because on Rising Up, your wonderful program, is one of the few places that one can even bring this up and discuss it. You asked, what is the implication for the United States? One area where France and the United States have had total cooperation ever since the Second World War, pretty much total cooperation all the time, except for de Gaulle's period when he pulled France out of NATO, is in the military. And Macron inherits, and it wasn't part of his campaign, and it isn't part of the plans that are now coming out of his campaign, he inherits an enormously active military. It is not numerous, but it is present all over the globe. Not as much as the United States is present, where the United States has overt and covert forces on just about every country you can name, but France in Africa and in Asia, and especially in the previous French colonies, has maintained a long, extremely corrupt and extremely corrupting presence in those countries. This expresses itself through something that Macron has not brought up and his opponents don't bring up, but it did come up tangentially a few times during the campaign, is that France is the fourth or fifth largest supplier of armaments in the world. We're talking about jet planes. We're talking about terrestrial vehicles. We're talking about weapons. We're talking about now, of course, drones and cyber war. So France is deeply into this, and France has ties to the United States establishment in those fields, which are extremely significant. I'll bet you that a big portion of the conversations where there was supposedly such body language hostility between Trump and Macron when they met the other week in France was about some of this. Well, can we count on you like we could count on President François Hollande? You know, Hollande was Obama's messenger boy. If Obama needed somebody to conduct an airstrike in the lamentably tortured countries of Syria and all around there and Kurdistan, who did he call up? He didn't want the United States to do it because it would be maybe called out by anti-United States people in various countries. He called Hollande. And one of the reasons why, and the French understand this perfectly well, there has been so much so-called terrorism on French soil, is that the people who are refugees from those countries or who are militants in those countries see very clearly the French presence in their countries and the damage that the French have done. Now, that doesn't justify any of these terrorist activities. Far from it. They're ghastly and horrible and indefensible and counterproductive. But it does explain them. To explain is not to excuse. And I think that one of the interesting things that's going to come up now is the first time that Macron, as commander-in-chief of the French military, authorizes, and the French are seen to be acting under Macron's mandate, and not to mention the factories. I mean, you talk about jobs. You know how many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of jobs in France are involved in production of all this military armaments and other material that I just talked about. It's a major factor worldwide, and that interacts with the United States.
Finally, Larry, you mentioned earlier if the Brexit vote were to be re-held today, it would go differently. And I'm wondering if you think if the general election in the United States were to be done over today, it would go differently.
Not if Hillary Clinton was running again.
Well, Larry, it's always a pleasure to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sonali, and thank you for all this excellent work. And it's good to speak to the Pacifica listeners again.
We'll be sure to have you back on again in the future. My guest is Larry Benski, longtime award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He teaches political science at Cal State University East Bay, and he's just finished teaching a class there on European government. And Larry Benski, of course, best known for his work on KPFA Pacifica Radio, where he won the George Polk Award for his coverage of the Iran-Contra hearings. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find out more about our show at risingupwithsonali.com, and also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.